This is the second morning of the retreat. Time goes very quickly when you're having fun. And what I wanted to talk about this morning is actually the problems which arise in meditation, how to overcome them. As this is the time of the retreat where you've already done a day's meditation and a bit, and you'd have noticed that it sounds very easy, in fact it is very easy, but sometimes it doesn't appear easy to you. And that's because there are the problems in meditation which come up, and unless one knows those problems and knows how to deal with them and overcome them, you can waste a lot of time and make it difficult for yourself. Again, the path of meditation has been well mapped out. The way to do meditation, the things to look out for, the problems and the benefits are very well known. And it's important that we make use of that age-old wisdom of how to meditate, what to look out for, so that we don't waste time. In particular, the way the Buddha taught the obstacles to meditation as the five hindrances. Those hindrances really mean just something which closes the door in your face, which doesn't allow you to go deeper into the meditation. You get so far, but you can't go any further. Sometimes those doors which are closed, almost like secret doors, and you can hardly know they're there until someone points them out to you. And once you see it, you can walk through that door and go deeper into meditation, go into other rooms of the house which you never thought existed. And these are all what we call like the doors which are closed in front of us in the pathway of meditation. So we have to know those doors. We have to know them in their coarse and refined form, and also know how to open them, what the key is, how to overcome them. So those five hindrances the Buddha called are kamachanda, sensory desire, ill will is number two, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and fifth is doubt. And you may have heard those before, you may think you understand them, but unless you can overcome them and get into the jhana state, it means you haven't really seen them fully yet. There's still one or two of those which are still obstructing you getting into the very deep meditation states. So I'm going to go through them carefully, one by one. And again, the reason why they're put in that order is very often because the most serious ones are the ones at the very beginning, and the more refined ones, the ones which are less of a problem, are lower down the order. The first one, kamachanda, sensory desire, is that illusion which we were talking about last night, which looks for excitement as a form of happiness rather than contentment, which wants to do and gather and make and become rather than just be. Is that which seeks for some happiness somewhere in this body, not realizing that happiness can never be found in this body. In the way of contemplation, that meditators, when we go on to the more insight practices, we often contemplate this thing we call pleasure and pain and pleasure, ugliness and beauty, and delicious food and undelicious food. And when you contemplate these things, it becomes very obvious to you that the beauty is dependent upon the ugliness, and the pleasure is dependent upon the pain on the pleasure. That's why that in all retreats I've ever taught, especially the long ones, when you come to the last day of the retreat, people look so happy. That's because they're going home. All the pain is going, so they feel so happy. But isn't it true that if you were tortured for 9 days, wouldn't it be the end of the 9 days be bliss? Can you see? And what I like to see at the end of a retreat is people very sad, because that shows they've been having such a good meditation that they're sad, they don't want to go home. So what they're actually saying there is that the pleasure, the pain and pleasure are dependent on each other. You can't have pleasure without some pain. If you had pleasure all the time, it would just be normal, natural, and you wouldn't notice it anymore. So what pain is only just the ending of pleasure, and a gap before more pleasure comes up. Beauty and ugliness, if everyone was beautiful, then the person who was just slightly less beautiful than others would be ugly. What we like to see, what we don't like to see, what we like to taste. I remember reading this article about this gourmet. We used to go along to these great restaurants in France, 4-star, 5-star restaurants, and it's very actually rare to get a 5-star chef these days. There's three or four 4-star chefs, the whole heap of 3-star chefs. But a person who's used to going to a 4-star chef, their restaurant, and then they go to a 3-star restaurant the next day, that 3-star restaurant food is disgusting. Whereas if it was me, 3-star restaurant, that'd be amazingly delicious. Because with all due respect to all the great cooks and the people who serve as monks, even because we put everything in the bowl, it might start off as 1 or 2 stars. By the time we finish mixing it all up, it's probably minus 1 or 2 stars. But whatever, you can see that it's the pleasure or the pain is so relative to what we've been experiencing before. And with due respect to us being in a Christian place today, I often contemplated the idea of the Christian heaven. Because when I was at school, they said in the Christian heaven, you've got to wear white clothes all the time, and you've got to have harp music, and you have ambrosia. And imagine what it'd be like living in heaven. Ambrosia for breakfast, ambrosia for lunch, ambrosia for dinner. Day after day, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years, you get sick to the teeth of ambrosia. Anything but ambrosia. And harp music. Harp music all day, all night. That really get up your nose. What we're really saying here, no matter how beautiful it is, if you have it all the time, you don't notice it. And this is the thing with pleasure and pain. That search for pleasure, only pleasure, and they're trying to get rid of pain, is a hopeless search. It is absolutely fruitless. You'll never be able to do it in this realm or any other realm, because all pleasure is at the expense of pain. That's why if ever you've been sick, the day after you recover from your sickness, you feel so healthy. One of the happiest times of your life is always the ending of some pain. People say that when they get married is the happiest day of their life, because of all that stress, worrying about it, thinking about it, planning for it, searching for it. Whatever it is, when you finish school, you finish your degree. Why is it when you go on holiday, you finally get on that plane and you're off? Why is it so happy? Because all the pain of going to work. That's why. So all the happiness you can actually see is dependent upon pain. When you actually see this, the actual search for happiness in this body, comfort in this body, is seen as it truly is, as a complete waste of time. So the first hindrance is actually seeing that, and seeing that seeking for pleasure, seeking for physical comfort in the realm of the five senses, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, is a complete waste of your energies and time. Instead of searching for happiness, just let this body be as it is. Aching, or just in comfort, leave it alone. Sounds outside, nice sounds, rotten sounds, good food, bad food, nice smells, rotten smells. It's very good that we don't have beans in this retreat. Whatever the smells are, or whatever the feelings are, so the sights are, just you can never make them perfect. So what one does is just to let go of all of that world. But it's amazing just how much of our time is concerned with trying to find comfort in that world of the five senses. Every time you move, even now. Why are you moving? It is because you're trying to find some comfort in this body. You know, you move your back, you move your legs, you scratch this, you take the body to the toilet, you put food in one end and it comes out the other end. This is all just trying to find some comfort in this body. You cough, you sneeze, you scratch, you fidget. It's that seeking for comfort, and you find no matter how much you eat, no matter how many times you go to the toilet, no matter how much you scratch, no matter how much you fidget, it still doesn't solve the problem, does it? You're still more fidgeted to glue, still more scratching. In fact, the more you scratch, the more you itch. The same, the more you seek for happiness in that world of the five senses, the more you crave. So, in our meditation, we actually give up that search for happiness in the realm of the five senses. We completely abandon it. And that is actually letting go of that hindrance. Now you can imagine, having said what the overcoming of that hindrance is, now you can perhaps understand the nature of that first hindrance, sensory desire. It's not just desire for wonderful food or wonderful music or wonderful this, wonderful that. It's just ordinary stuff. It's the biggest form of that hindrance. Every time you fit it in the meditation, that is the hindrance of sensory desire. Every time you go listening outside when you're supposed to be silent, that is sensory desire, looking for something to stimulate you, to distract you. Every time you scratch, or you cough, or you move the body, sensory desire, trying to find comfort. And you can understand just how that keeps on disturbing you during your meditation period. Keeps on disturbing you because it never gives you any bodily tranquility where the body can just be still and disappear. It's a strange thing, but those of you who've done lots of meditation, if you ask yourself, when has your body been the most comfortable? Is it, say, while you've been having sex? Is it while you've been having a great meal? Is it while you've been listening to great music? Or is it that time in your meditation when you've just been, closed your eyes, and the body feels so peaceful? Which is the most pleasurable? Ask yourself those questions. And I think you'll probably find the answer, which certainly I found. In meditation, when you just leave the body alone, you don't even try and move it, to change it, do whatever, that is when it's the most peaceful. When you let it go. And don't think that, you know, all these pains and aches in the body, you have to do something with them. There's been times in my life as a monk meditating where I've been in great pain and great discomfort. Just the first year I was a monk in Thailand that I got scrub typhus and a typhus fever. In those days we didn't actually know what it was, we thought it was typhoid. It was a very bad fever, so lots of the monks used to get it in those days. Not really knowing what it was, we got sent to the hospital. And this was like a third world hospital, in a sort of, actually a poor part of the third world, 25 years ago in Thailand. And there was a monk's ward, so big ward, about 10 beds on either side, 20 monks, all sick. And, you know, straight away, you're only 1 year as a monk, you're really wondering what was going on, and whether this was actually safe. And I just remember, just, you know, with a drip in my arm, feeling really rotten. At 6 p.m. the first night there, the male nurse went away. And I was really surprised that the night nurse hadn't come on. I thought they must be late. So I asked one of the other monks, "Where's the night nurse?" He said, "There's no night nurse. Just if you happen to sort of die or get ill during the middle of the night, that's just, you know, unfortunate karma." That's it. So for 12 hours you had these very, very sick monks with no one to look after them at all. No one to call. You know, it was like frightening. And like being sick and no one really knowing what it was, having great high fevers, you know, he was being pumped with all his antibiotics. And again, this was 25 years ago, a very poor hospital in the sticks of a third world country. And this was a long time before the age of disposable syringes and needles. So the needles would be used again and again and again. And I was pretty sure that once they finished using the needles in Bangkok, they sent them out to Ubon in the hospital alone. Because these were really blunt. And even though I was supposed to be a monk and be tough, every time this nurse came in, I still remember even now just to wrap the needles in this green cloth. As soon as I saw the green cloth, I'm going, oh no. Because she'd actually stab you in the backside with these needles. And he had to really use force to get them in. And, oh, it really hurt. And my bottom was really so sore. Twice a day. I don't know what they were pumping in me either. But anyway, I do recall that after a couple of weeks being in this hospital, actually that was a time just when I was uplifted for about 5 minutes when Ajahn Chah came to see me. And imagine what it's like, you're a young monk and this great teacher, you know, he's only a small man, but a great teacher, came to see you, felt, ah, so wonderful, you know, my teacher's come to see me, Ajahn Chah's come to see me. And you felt so happy until he opened his mouth. Because that was the time he said, you know, through the interpreter, he said, Brahma Wang, so he said, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. And then he left. Thank you very much. It was actually, you know, those times, those teachings, you don't really appreciate them at the time, but afterwards you contemplate them and they're great teachings. But anyway, one day, just, you know, being very, very sick, and having a fever and just feeling really rotten in a hospital a long way away, just didn't know what conditions they were in and probably get even sicker being in hospital, I felt really depressed and really sort of, you know, lonely, hurting, tired. So what I did then was decide to meditate. And even though you're not supposed to meditate when you've got a fever and when you're tired and you've got no energy, I did it. I got in this really beautiful state of meditation. Just the body disappeared. It was great. The first time in weeks, I had no pain in the body. I had no body. And it just really showed me just what you can do. You know, if you really sort of, you know, have a bit of skill and a bit of courage to let go. So that showed me that it doesn't matter any old time. If you really have the skill, really want to, you can get into deep meditation, even in pain, weakness, tiredness, or whatever. So don't think that these irritations of the body are something which is really stopping you. It's your concern for those irritations. It's your concern for that pain. It's your concern for that tiredness. That is what is the hindrance. Sensory desire. So the way to overcome that hindrance is that hindrance is always trying to find some more comfortable posture, comfortable sound, comfortable this, comfortable that in the five senses. The only way to overcome that is actually to develop the contentment inside the mind, the ability to let go, to say no to pleasure and pain, to beauty and ugliness, to see that they're both connected, you can't have one without the other, so give up the search for exclusive happiness or beauty. You don't have to give it up forever, just give it up for half an hour, or however long you're meditating for. When you're sitting here, you itch, just leave it alone. Don't scratch. You've got a minor ache, don't move. Just take the mind completely away from that ache and go on to the breath or wherever. As I say, that if you can get onto that breath pretty quickly in the meditation, present moment awareness, silence, and get into that breath, and when you focus into the breath, the whole body disappears. You're not really concerned about feelings in the body. You're not concerned about sounds or smells, tastes. And the eyes are closed, so you can't see anything. The whole five senses are turned off. Click, 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 click. Five things are turned off. You're not concerned about pleasure or pain. You're not concerned about that realm at all. And that gives you a great sense of freedom. I'm just scratching my nose now. So often that you're just always irritated by trying to scratch this or move that. Even when you go to sleep at night, you always have to keep moving backwards and forwards to find the most comfortable posture. is endless. That's actually torture. Tortured by the five senses. The first hindrance is just that, trying to find comfort. And it also manifests in the thinking about finding comfort. Now, what are we going to have for lunch? What am I going to do next? There's actually the seeking for comfort now and the thoughts about it. So please know that hindrance is all concerned with this body and its comfort, its pleasure. Let go of that just for the time of the meditation and you get a great deal of freedom. The second of the hindrances is called ill will. And I mentioned that briefly last night, that ill will is very easily seen if it's ill will towards another person because they're irritating you or they're upsetting you. They're not supposed to be talking, but they are talking. Forget what they're doing. Just if they're doing something wrong, that karma will look after that. You don't need to sort of be the executioner. And sometimes if you get ill will to another person, just like I was saying, that person who's breathing very heavily during that Sydney retreat, because they had cancer, that's all he could do. So just leave other people alone. They're all following their own paths, doing what they can do, as best they can do. So don't keep judging other people. So it's reasonably easy to let go of ill will towards another person. What it's much harder to do is to get rid of ill will towards oneself. And this becomes a very deep hindrance, the ill will towards oneself. Sometimes we think we have got no ill will towards ourselves, but I tell the story of some years ago, one of the nuns from England who was visiting started to tell me that they went into a reasonably deep meditation. They could see that it was possible to go deeper and to get into real bliss and power. And the only thing which stopped them was the thought which arose in their mind saying, I don't deserve so much happiness. And when she told me that, I could see very easily that that's so in so many people. When you get into the very deep meditations, it starts really getting blissful. Sometimes ill will towards oneself. I don't deserve happiness. Stops you from succeeding in the meditation. And that is a very deeply rooted psychosis in people's minds. It comes from the Western idea of guilt, that you're not perfect enough to enjoy happiness. And so people, because of that guilt, because of feeling imperfect, unclean or whatever, they will not allow themselves to go deep enough into meditation to experience a bit of peace and happiness in their life. They think they don't deserve it. And you have to be very careful with that attitude, because that is profound, very deeply rooted in the mind, and unless it's pointed out to you, you might miss it. And that might be your big hindrance which stops you succeeding in meditation. Simply put, you don't allow yourself to succeed. You put obstacles in your way to make sure you fail. So look at that. In Buddhism, in the Dharma, sort of, there's nothing which you can't forgive. The worst thing you possibly have done in your life, you can forgive that. What forgiveness means is you're allowing yourself to be happy. What guilt is you're seeking for punishment, you're seeking for pain. You won't allow yourself to be happy. And of course, that is a stupid idea, because all the punishments, they don't really help. If you made a mistake, acknowledge what you've done, you made a mistake, forgive yourself, and learn from it. You've got a type of football in Australia called the AFL code. You see, like the Australian rules. And this is why I call this the AFL code. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. When you make a mistake. But there's no reason for guilt or feeling sorry for yourself. Move on from that. And this is actually what the Buddha said. He said, if you make a mistake, if you acknowledge it and learn from it, that's growth, he says, in the Dhamma, growth in the tradition. So there's no need for punishment, certainly no need for punishing yourself. So if you find that you can get so quiet and then you can't get any quieter, then just check whether you are allowing yourself to be peaceful. And just to make sure, at the beginning of a meditation, you can even make that resolution to yourself. I allow myself to be happy. I give myself permission to have bliss. I give myself permission to have bliss. It's okay to bliss out. Say that to yourself, because that might be overcoming the hindrance of many, many years deep down inside of you because of some perceived faults or mistakes of telling yourself, I don't deserve to be happy. That attitude of giving yourself permission to have bliss, to have happiness, again is called loving kindness. You give loving kindness to other people. When you give loving kindness to others, what do you want them to be? You want them to have happiness. You want them to have joy. That's what loving kindness is all about. May all beings be happy. May all beings be blissed out. May everyone in this room be enlightened, even if I'm not. That's what you should do. Not say, I want to be enlightened before the person sitting next to me. Certainly, I've got to be enlightened before my husband. I can't let him be. Whatever it is, don't get into those sorts of states of mind. See if you can have that loving kindness as you give to others. May other people be happy, be bliss, be enlightened. Give that to yourself. Give yourself permission. And then that ill will towards yourself is being abandoned. Try that out, because I've found in many retreats that that has been one of the biggest hindrances to people. Simply that closing the door of happiness to themselves. They don't allow themselves to be happy. And that's why they're always seeking for something to think about, to distract themselves, to have pain. They always want to sit a bit longer, to have a bit more hurts, because they don't want to be happy. There are all these chairs, there's still lots of chairs which are empty on the back there. So why don't you want to be happy? Sit without the pain in your legs or your back. Crazy. You must be into some guilt trip. You hate yourself and you want to have pain. Just say when you sort of you have breakfast, eat a lot. Enjoy your breakfast. Enjoy your lunch. Have fun. Because that perception of happiness, a perception of beauty, is very important in a meditation retreat. You allow yourself to enjoy. But another deep part of that hindrance of ill will is the ill will towards the meditation object itself. And after a couple of days you get sick of the teeth of meditation. And watching the breath, just what a waste of time this is. I don't get this. And be careful you don't have ill will towards the meditation object, the breath, or present moment awareness. Present moment awareness again, this is stupid. Because if you have ill will towards the object, the only way you hold it is with force. Because ill will means the object you're trying to push away the object with one part of your mind, the other one you're trying to hold on to it. There's this tension there. And it never succeeds. You always fail. But instead of having ill will towards a meditation object, if you have loving kindness towards a meditation object, beautiful present moment. One of my most wonderful friends. Isn't it nice to hang out with your friend at the present moment? Silence. We've had so many good times in the past with my good old friend Silence. He's always waiting there for me. Whenever I want to go and hang out with Silence, it's always there. Such a faithful friend. And it had so much happiness together, me and Silence. And especially the breath. That's a very, very deep and old friend. I've known that person ever since I was born, my breath. It's always been so faithful, even though I haven't been paying any attention at all. The breath has still been doing its job. Even though I've been busy and running around, the breath has still been doing its job. Talk about someone who's faithful. The breath has never let me down yet. And so you have loving kindness towards the dear old breath. If you have loving kindness towards the breath, you don't need to force the attention on the breath. no more than you to force yourself to stay with a good friend. Now, I don't know who your best friend is in life. Isn't it nice just to have a cup of coffee with your best friend? Just to go out to a nice little shop somewhere and you talk about this and you talk about that. It doesn't really matter what you're talking about. It's just like hanging out with a good friend. And even though you've got so many other things you have to do in life, you're so busy. When it's a good friend, everything else becomes of secondary importance. That's why if you look at your breath as being a really good friend, then it's easy to watch the breath. Instead of having hatred towards it, this is my enemy, I've got to get rid of him sooner or later. The quicker the better. If you look upon it as a good friend, then you're just so content with the breath. So give friendship and kindness and loving kindness towards every meditation object which you have. And then you find it's effortless, the meditation. The mind just wants to stay there. That's how we overcome ill will. The next of the hindrances is called sloth and torpor. I wanted to move on to this quickly because I saw a couple of people yawning. But again, sloth and torpor is just like, again, it's a refined form of the first hindrance of Kamachanda, and also a little bit of ill will there as well. You just want to escape from existing because you're not having any fun yet. You're not enjoying the meditation, it hasn't really bitten yet. And because of that, sort of you're trying to escape into this dull state. And the mind loves to go into dullness because you don't feel any pain, you don't feel any pleasure, you don't feel anything at all, you're just absolutely dull. And it's also a form of ill will because basically if you really love the meditation and you've got friendship towards a loving kind, friendship towards the meditation object, of course, when you won't fall asleep, you're enjoying, you know, your pleasurable company. The same way, if you're with a friend and having a nice time together, you never sort of yawn or fall asleep. So, that loving kindness is also a great way of overcoming that sloth and torpor. But in particular, sloth and torpor comes up when you get to a certain stage in the meditation, and you've got like a fork in the road. You can take the left fork and it leads to sloth and torpor. You're dull, you're peaceful, but you're not aware of what's going on. Or you can take the other fork in the road. You can keep as peaceful, but you're fully aware of what's happening. To explain the matter in more detail, there's two parts to the mind, the doer and the knower. The doer is this thing which starts thinking up, which controls, which wants to make this happen or that happen, get rid of this, bring this in. That's the doer. The knower is consciousness, that which is listening to me, that which feels the pain, that which knows what's happening. That's the knower. In meditation, you're supposed to be calming down the doer. If this is a doer, this is a knower. Calming down the doer, but keep the knower sharp. Keep mindfulness very, very sharp. But a lot of times the doer and the knower for most people is just so intimately linked. When you calm one down, the other gets pulled down with it. So when you're calming doing down, the knowing starts to calm down. You're letting go of both. So don't calm the knower, calm the doer. And keep the knower as bright and as sharp as ever. If you can see the difference between those two aspects of the mind, the knower and the doer, then you're 90% of the way of overcoming sloth and torpor. You can do nothing, but you're perfectly awake, perfectly aware. All the deep meditations are not trances. The deep meditations are where you're more aware, more alert than ever. The consciousness is so bright and sharp. That's why it's energetic. The way to overcome that, again, knowing this, and also putting energy into the meditation, enjoying the meditation, putting fun into the meditation, making it enjoyable, making it a game. For those of you who suffer from sloth and torpor a lot, especially in the early morning, you can try the counting technique. Just go on to the breath straight away, breathing in one, breathing out one. Breathing in two, breathing out two. Breathing in three, out three. In four, out four. In five, out five. In six, out seven. In eight, out eight. Breathing in nine, breathing out nine. Once you've got to nine, then start again at one. Breathing in one, out one. Two, two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, six, seven, seven. Breathing in eight, breathing out eight. Stop at eight this time. Then start at one again. Breathing in one, out one. Two, two, three, three, four, four, five, five, six, six. In seven, out seven. Only to seven this time. The next time for one to six, then one to five, one to four. Then breathing in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three. Then breathing in one, out one, in two, out two. Then breathing in one, out one. When you've done a whole cycle, that's 45 breaths in a row, you've remembered. Now what will happen if you've got sloth and torpor? This is what happened to me when I started doing this. Breathing in one, out one, in two, out three. In 19, out 19. You haven't had the mindfulness. Or sometimes in one, out two. Where was I? Now if that happens to you, you've got to go right back to the very beginning again. Into one. So it makes a bit of a game with it. When it's a bit of a game, it makes it more interesting. Gives you something more to do. But you're still watching the breath. It has to be in the present moment. You have to be mindful. So you can try messing around with those counting. You can do it other ways if you want, just to make it more interesting. Instead of doing the counting that way, breathing in one, out one, you can actually change it around. Breathing out one, breathing in one. Breathing out two, breathing in two. It looks the same, but because you're doing it a different way, it takes much more attention. That's the same way also during this retreat. During this retreat, if you suffer from dullness, start to mess around with your schedule. Do things differently. Turn the pillow the other way around on the bed and sleep the opposite direction. When you get up in the morning, instead of going to the toilet before brushing your teeth, brush your teeth before you go to the toilet. Whatever it is. Because when you become a creature of habit, that's when you get dull. Even something as simple like when you brush your teeth, what part of the mouth do you start on first of all? Is it sort of the top left-hand tooth or the bottom right-hand one? Whatever it is, notice that, and tomorrow morning start from the opposite end. When you have to do things differently, not out of habit but out of mindfulness, you're more awake. So don't always do things the same way. That makes you more alive, more alert, even in simple things. So doing this is a way of overcoming sloth and torpor, and especially enjoyment, interest. When you're really enjoying what you're doing, and remember also how much you paid for this, and how hard it is to get this sort of money. And so you can't waste a moment of this, can you? So be careful of sloth and torpor. But if you're a person who suffers from sloth and torpor, don't feel bad about this or worried about this. Because that used to be one of my biggest hindrance, was sloth and torpor when I was a young monk. In our monastery, the abbot used to sort of always have his eyes open when he was meditating in the morning. When someone would start nodding, he'd sort of point out, James, you're nodding. Cece, you're asleep, wake up. And I always used to be number two monk, all the time. There used to be another monk, a guy called Gary. He was always the first to nod, but I was always number two, close behind. So I was a great nodder. But I got a lot of confidence when I started reading the teachings. When I found out that one of the best meditators in the time of the Buddha, Venerable Mahamoggallana, was also a great nodder. And one of the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, he was walking with his attendant Ananda at the edge of a forest. He saw this monk sitting on the edge of the forest, dead straight, perfect back, not nodding at all. And he said, I'm worried about that monk. And sure enough, a few weeks later, that monk disrobed. And then he went deep into the forest. He saw this other monk trying to meditate, nodding this way, nodding that way. And the Buddha smiled and said, I'm not worried about him. And sure enough, a few weeks later, he became an arahat, fully enlightened. Of all the hindrances, the nodders are the ones you have to be less worried about. They're peaceful, but they don't know it. They just need to get that little bit more mindfulness, a little more brightness coming up, and then they'll be very peaceful, but very alert. And they'll be great meditators. So if sloth and talk is your hindrance, then you're in good company. The next hindrance is restlessness and remorse. The remorse part of it is the worry because you may have done something bad in the past, very close to the ill will. And that stops again you getting sort of happiness. You don't allow yourself to be happy. Remorse is always overcome by forgiveness. Doesn't matter what you've done in the world, you can always forgive it and let go. So don't carry around the burden of the past. No one forces you to do that, and you don't have to do that. It's not expected of you. Please let go. The restlessness, though, which I'm sure many of you know, is when you're sitting down here, you've got nothing to do, but you insist on doing something. You insist on finding something to do. Anything, just but be still. That's restlessness. And all restlessness comes from what I was talking about yesterday, the fault-finding mind. Because wherever you are, even in heaven, you can always find fault. That's why this was broken heaven once. And he had this great vision of hell. And instead of ambrosia, they had this really good, nice food, you know, with big menus. If you want junk food, if you have junk food, you can only die once. This is Christian joke, so Christian heaven. So it doesn't matter what you eat when you go to heaven, eat whatever you like. And also, no harp music, they have really good rock bands. And instead of like sort of this white gowns people were wearing, people had really sort of nifty clothes, really, you know, chic dresses and nice suits. And so I went up to one of the angels there and he said, look, I just had this vision of hell there. They've got really good food over there and nice music, you know, and they've got really nice clothes. Can't we have that up here? And the angel said, of course we can't. So why not? It's tradition. We've always worn white gowns. We've always had ambrosia and harp music. We can't change a tradition just for you. He said, look, I worked very hard to get up in heaven. I gave up a lot. And I deserve my pleasures now. And the angel said, no, sorry. But if you really want to enjoy those pleasures, why don't you go down the hill? He said, okay, I will. So he went down the hill, and as soon as he got down the hill, these really ugly, fearsome demons took hold of him and put him in a pot of boiling oil and started pricking him with these prongs. He said, hey, hang on, what about all the beautiful music and the nice food and all the nice dresses and stuff? He said, oh, that's only our advertising campaign. That's today's joke. So anyway, so even like in heaven, you can always find fault like that guy did and see where it got him. So that fault-finding mind is the cause of restlessness because you're not happy where you are, so you go looking for something else. How can you ever find rest? Do you have to make things perfect first before you can rest? If you do, if that's how you feel, you've got to make things perfect. Everything all settled in its nice pigeonhole, all your letters written, all your business well looked after, all your kids and husband, wife, all sort of settled. You'd never be able to get to this retreat, would you? How many people have left unfinished business and back at home? Or at the office, or at the monastery. It's the only way, isn't it? You have to have peace, rest in imperfection with so many unfinished ends. You will die with so much unfinished business. That's just the nature of things. So the only way to have a bit of rest is in imperfection. That's why that story I told about that monk in Thailand who was building a hall And during the rains retreat, the monsoon period, he stopped all building. And someone came to ask him, when is your hall going to be finished? And he said, it is finished. And the person was taken aback. What do you mean the hall is finished? There's no roof, there's no windows, the doors haven't been fixed yet. It's a mess, it's a building site. And this monk's answer was the key to overcoming this fourth hindrance of restlessness. He said, what's done is finished. Beautiful answer. What's done is finished. So even though no roof on yet, no doors, things all over the place, what's done is finished. So for you, that's the case. What's done is finished. So you don't have to keep bringing up all the business from the past. It's finished for this retreat. After the retreat, you do it again, and it begins again. So be careful of that restlessness, the fault-finding mind. It has to be finished, it has to be perfect before you can have some rest. Don't get stuck in that trap. When there's no place, you're not looking for a better time, you're not looking for a better thought, you're not looking for a better meditation object, you're just happy where you are. Each of these stages of meditation can be compared to a lotus flower. The next stage is not on to the next flower, and the next flower, and the next flower. The next stage is into this flower which you're looking at right now. The silence is right in the middle of the present moment. Not to the left, not to the right. You don't have to abandon the present moment to get into the silence. You just have to go deeper into the present moment. And there you find the silence. You don't have to abandon the silence to get the breath. Right in the middle of that silence, you will find the breath. You don't need to abandon the coarse breath to get the refined breath. The beautiful breath is right in the center of the ordinary breath. When you get to nimittas, you don't need to abandon the breath to get to a nimitta. The nimitta, this beautiful light in the mind, is right in the center of the beautiful breath. Right in the middle of it. You don't need to abandon anything, just more contentment, more being with what you already have. Don't throw away this. Just make more of this. That's why letting go of doing things is a way of going inwards. Wanting the next stage is you go off this lotus to something else and you miss the whole path. Letting go is just staying where you are. That's why the part of meditation is doing nothing. Letting go. You sit here and everything comes to you. Just the lotus opens out for you. And right in the middle of that nimitta, the very central point is the doorway into the jhanas. You don't need to throw away the nimitta. That's why when people ask, what should you do next? That is restlessness. That idea shows you haven't overcome restlessness yet. You want to do something more. Shut up, do nothing. Be absolutely content. Rest with the meditation stage you're at now, and the next stage will come. If you rest in the silence and find complete rest in that silence, so the breath will come up. If you have complete rest in the breath, then the beautiful breath will come up. If you're resting in a beautiful breath, not trying to get further into the nimitta, the nimittas will come up all by themselves. But you're resting with that nimitta, you don't want to get into jhanas, you don't not want to get into jhanas, you don't care at all. You have complete rest in this wonderful nimitta. It's so peaceful, so soothing. Then the jhanas happen. In the lotus, going in. So be careful of restlessness, always wanting to do something else. But what should I do next? Idea. That is the core of restlessness. It means you're not happy where you are. It means you want something more. You're finding fault. The last hindrance is doubt. That last hindrance of doubt, it can be doubt as the teacher, doubt in the teaching, but more importantly, doubt in your own ability. Sometimes you think, oh, these jhanas, enlightenment, only monks and nuns can get these things. That's not the case. In the time of the Buddha, there were many lay people who were non-returners. Many lay people got jhanas. They can, why not you? So don't doubt your own ability. Any coach of any sportsman, sportswoman or sports team, the main job is to say, you can. And there's always surprises, aren't there? You know, sort of in sports, you know, the team which is not supposed to win, you know, wins. You know, the player who's supposed to be the underdog does amazing things and so wins the whole tournament. This only happens when they've got a good coach who says, you can win, it's possible. Because that confidence, that faith in your own ability is what matters. So please have confidence. I can do this. I can reach the very highest. Now. Don't worry about the morning, the first part of your meditation. You may have had terrible meditation in the first 15 minutes. And you think, okay, this is a rotten meditation. That's not having faith in yourself. You can turn the meditation around just on a pinhead. From a rotten meditation to a beautiful meditation, just like that. Don't doubt that you can't do it. It's possible. So that way you're not allowing the past to imprison you in the present moment. No matter what you've done in the past, doesn't matter. The present moment is completely open. All possibilities are there. So don't doubt at all. Those are the five hindrances. Find out if you are stuck in meditation, which hindrance or group of them is actually stopping you going deeper. Don't just sit there and have a bad meditation and think, oh, it's just a bad meditation, it's me. It's a hindrance. It's nothing to do with you. It's just a hindrance. Find out which hindrance it is. Use that framework of the five hindrances. Once you find out what that hindrance is, then know how to overcome it. What the remedy is. Just like a good doctor. Once you know what the remedy is, learn how to apply it. The way to apply it is using what I call the simile of the snake. When I was in Northeast Thailand, in these monasteries, we used to go to the evening meetings in the main hall. We used to have to walk back to our kutis in the middle of the night. In those early years, sometimes there was no batteries for the flashlights. So you'd have to go by starlight or by moonlight if there was any moon. And sometimes you didn't even have any shoes because there wasn't enough thongs. If your thongs broke, you have to wait for a long time, try and repair them if you could. So a lot of the time you're walking barefoot through the jungle at night time, knowing that there was all sorts of creepy crawlies, especially snakes. And if you trod on one, you're in big trouble. Now, many times I walked back through the jungle barefoot. Many times I saw snakes, but never once did they bite me, because I would always avoid them, step over them, or make a detour. You know how I achieved that? Because in the evening I knew there were snakes around, I knew there were a danger, therefore I was on the lookout for them as I walked on the path. Therefore I saw them and could step around them. This is a simile for hindrances. When you're going on the path of meditation, there's all these hindrances, the five types of snakes, ready to bite you and cause you big trouble. Especially know the one which is the most dangerous, which has bitten you so many times. It's there, waiting for you. If you know it's there, and you're on the lookout for it, you'll be able to avoid it. Step around it. For example, sloth and torpor, that's a python which strangles you. If that's your biggest hindrance, you know it's there waiting for you. When you start meditating, there's no sloth and torpor. You know it's in there on the path somewhere. Tell yourself it's like a snake. Watch out for that snake. And then you'll see it before it has a chance to catch you. You'll be able to avoid it. If it's restlessness or thinking, whatever it is your big hindrance in meditation, identify your major obstacle. call it a snake. The beginning of the meditation, set mindfulness up to look out for that. And you'll find that it's about to get you. Because you're on the lookout, you'll be able to avoid it. And you'll be able to bypass that hindrance and go much deeper. There'll be many more refined snakes further on the path, but get the gross ones out of the way first of all. And then you'll be able to go very deep into the meditation. And you find you won't be wasting your time, you'll be getting your money's worth in this meditation retreat. So know those hindrances. Know them very well. Know the way around them. And then you'll be able to have some wonderful experiences in this meditation. Okay, any questions on this talk about the obstacles to meditation? Yeah?
If there are two ways of using counting to meditate, when you're doing a walking meditation, you suggest that you're
when you're doing walking meditation, you can try walking backwards. It's a good way. Walk outside in the cold. Start to think of snakes or creepy crawlies or something. Or another way, which is one of the monks, this was a Thai method. If you're walking, instead of counting, this is a great way for overcoming sloth and torpor. Instead of counting, when you move your left foot, say to yourself, it's like a mantra, I will die. As you move your right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Backwards and forwards. Every left foot, I will die. Right foot, that's for sure. Keep on going. Don't give that up. Quarter of an hour, 20 minutes. You find you don't get tired. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. It's a great sort of little technique there for doing walking meditation. Try it every now and again. You come straight, very quickly you come to fear. It's true, we all know this, but we're reminding ourselves again and again and again and again. We come to this huge fear. This is actually true, I am going to die, I don't know when. And then afterwards, because death is quite clearly in your perception, just all these other things which cause restlessness, which you occupy your mind, seem just so irrelevant and petty. So many hindrances just completely disappear. And you feel so peaceful. And just so wonderful and so grateful just to be in the present moment. So if that comes up, that fear, welcome that, because just on the other side of that fear is a beautiful release.
Can meditation become a ritual?
Can meditation become a ritual? It can be if you don't put fun into it. Make it fun, don't always do the same thing. Don't be a creature of habit, because otherwise it gets slothful. Sit in a different way, do different things. So make it interesting. You can make it fun. That's one of my biggest teachings, which I'm sure I'll try very hard to get across. Meditation is fun. Make it lively, make it enjoyable. It'd be just the most beautiful thing in the whole world. So when it's fun, it's not a ritual anymore.
I did try walking meditation. One foot saying death is certain, another foot saying life is uncertain. Certain life is uncertain.
Yeah.
But too much of a repetition, it becomes like just no meaning, just lose itself.
Well, if you keep on at it, eventually that it's like brainwashing. Eventually, the mind succumbs and listens to what's being said. The mind will rebel. At first, I don't want to hear this. This is stupid. This is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. I'm going to get depressed. I'm going to get suicidal. Stop thinking like that. Just keep on doing it. And you'll find after a while you break through and it's fun. So, you know, do things like that. I will die, that's for sure.
So, in other words, when there's pain, can you say that's not pain?
No, instead of saying that's pain, I said wonderful pain. Beautiful pain. You're my best friend. Because the thing of poor pain, no one likes pain. So I'm going to like it. Because I'm always like the underdogs. People who get rejected by everyone else, I like to take in. You know, like some of these people, they're taking stray cats, which no one else wants. So take in stray pain. No one else looks after Payne, and poor old Payne feels so lonely, can't find a home anywhere. So you take in Payne and be kind to him, because no one wants it at all. Think how lonely and rejected Payne must feel. Whenever it comes to visit someone, they always shut the door in its face. You've got no friends, Payne. So you be a friend to Payne. Thank you, Payne, for coming to visit me. Poor thing. No one likes you. You see how it's messing around and changing around? It makes you laugh and straight away the pain's gone. So make the meditation fun, enjoy it. And just if it's pain, just play around with it. And see if you can move the pain around the body or whatever it is. And find out what it is and what you want anyway. Come inside. You've heard me say before about the demon in the emperor's palace. You know that story? The demon comes into the emperor's palace, all the other people in the palace say, get out of here, you don't belong. It grows an inch bigger, an inch smellier, an inch uglier, a bit uglier every time it gets rejected. Get out of here, you don't belong. Emperor comes back, says, welcome, demon. How come that no one's got you a cup of tea yet? Do you want something to eat? How about some noodles? I shouldn't mention noodles to Singapore people, otherwise they start getting hungry. you don't get any noodles here in this retreat. So whatever it is, sort of look after that demon. Well, every time, every kind word, kind act, kind thought that emperor gave to the demon grew an inch smaller. Until eventually the demon vanished completely away. And that's why the Buddha called that an anger-eating demon. You give the demon anger, and it gets bigger and more smelly, more offensive, more of a problem. Pain is the ultimate anger-eating demon. You get pain, and you give it anger, get out of here, you don't belong. Now why are you coming to visit me? Give it love, give it kindness. Then it gets an inch smaller. Less of a problem. So be kind to your pain. It's come here to teach you something. So welcome it. Great fun.